So again, my name is Brittany. I'm Tricycle's online course manager, and I am here with John Peacock and Jake Dartington to answer the questions that have come up for you while going through demystifying Nirvana. We're on for an hour, so I'm not going to waste any more of it. I'm going to hand you over to them for your questions. You can raise your Zoom virtual hand. You can also type your question in the chat and I can read it out for you if you'd prefer not to speak up. So, Jake, John, thank you so very much for being here with us
Thank you.
all, and I'll hand it over to both of you.
Thank you, Brittany. And yes, a very, very warm welcome to all of you. Really, really nice to be with you. Before we have our first question, we're just going to take a moment to arrive. So, finding a posture where you can feel alert, where you can feel at ease. Just a moment to intentionally shift space into our time together. Noticing how things are for you as we begin today. Maybe you're arriving when things feel smooth and easy, or maybe more stirred up. But as much as feels possible, simply noticing whatever's present in this moment. And in the midst of all that's here, grounding the attention in the breath, in the body, taking a moment to be still. So, thank you. Thank you, everyone. Really nice to be with you. Nice to be here with Brittany and with John as well. We're looking forward to seeing what questions have come up for you as you've been exploring this material. I saw that you've had a really good and interesting session with Christina, so I guess you have a good sense of how this all works now. You can raise your Zoom hand to ask a question, or you can put a question in the chat. And yeah, it'd be lovely to hear what's on your mind from what you've seen so far in the course.
Lucinda, I think Lucinda Green, I can see your hands up.
Wonderful.
I'll ask you to unmute, and that should show up on your screen.
Thank you. I couldn't find the raised hand. Am I unmuted?
Yep.
I had a question for you, Jake. I was really fascinated when you were talking about the 10 fetters and how when one falls away, another one is just there, and I was just scrambling to get my list. I was like, oh, hey, what are the last five? Because you did the first five, and I kind of made up some of my own. But, desiring to be born in a material realm, desiring to be born in an immaterial realm. I just wondered, the conceit, the restlessness, if you would just fill that in, the last five. You kind of did it off the cuff, I thought, but. It was like, wait, he stopped.
Yes, thank you. Good. Well, again, this is one that I'm sure John can come in with as well. If I'm being honest with you, I think there's probably quite a good reason I tend to focus on the first five, in that, there seems to be a lot there in the midst of our everyday lives to really be with, and in a lot of teaching, there's a particular emphasis on the first three, really, that are,
Stream entry.
opening up that sort of profound stage of stream entering. And then the next two, as you see, sense, desire, and ill will fall away. For me, again, there are really some very deep questions around those last five. I mean, one of them is definitely, well, in my understanding, would be a wish for the jhanist. That's that kind of wish to be reborn in these formless realms, a wish for these very refined meditative experiences, or as you say, the traditional wish to be reborn in form. And then those ones that you mentioned. For me, it's quite a contemplation, say, around conceit. For me, that comes back to the very first one, which is letting go of self view, personality view. And I do sit with that as a question. Is it a more kind of subtle version of that, or is it something quite different? I mean, my understanding, again, it would be the subtle remnants of that tendency to identify. And again, restlessness, because I would have assumed that a very gross form of restlessness may have left earlier, in that model. So again, I wonder if it's the sense of all of them is sort of last vestiges of these kind of afflictive things that can be around. That's how I would see those five. But I'd love to hear from John on this. I really would.
Okay, I'd like to respond if you don't mind. It's interesting. My understanding of the conceit. I'm a Dharma teacher, by the way, and I was taking a class with another Dharma teacher, and it was on anatta. And he said, sometimes I find when I leave a room, there's just a little sniff of an odor of myself in it, and I really love that image as kind of like the subtleness of it. And then my understanding of the restlessness at that point is coming from the conceit, because as you're saying, there's still that very subtle sense of self there, and that is the source of the restlessness. That still, and then finally the ignorance. I just only came up with one. I would think that restlessness, when it's gone, and this is just what I would think, it would be peace, or one of those would be freedom or peace. Because you were talking about what emerges naturally when the others are seen through.
Thank you, Lucinda. John, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Unmuted. Actually, my response to that is going to be slightly odd.
I'm not so far.
The sense that turn them on their head, start with ignorance at the top, and then go down, and you're getting, if you like, the more proximate things that you see which are manifesting in your life. So if ignorance, and actually, I don't even like the word ignorance, it's more a sense of confusion. If there's a sense of confusion about life, about existential issues, about being in the world, all of these things, then it's obviously inevitably going to give rise to restlessness. And the first manifestations of restlessness will be comparison. You start to compare yourself. Now, if we go back to the traditional model, I don't tend to take the traditional modeling too seriously. Of this. What they have is a map. They decided they've got a map of four stages to awakening. And so therefore they've got to kind of move the two lists together, the map of the four stages of awakening, from the stream entry to Arahat, with the 10 fetters and what's eliminated at various stages. I don't take that too seriously. I think what it is just a map of the density of the problem that we have. And I think you're absolutely right in saying that restlessness is that, I don't know, the odor of self. Yeah, it's that mere odor of self that's just left over. Because actually, if you think about it, Sakya ditti has been eliminated supposedly earlier on. So the gross manifestation of it is gone. So what you're talking about is the most subtle manifestation of it. It's still linked to restlessness, and I think you're absolutely right on that. The biggest problem, the deepest problem, of course, is then the confusion. And how do you eliminate the confusion? And then that's the big question for the whole of early Buddhism and, and later forms of Buddhism as well. So in a way, I started in an odd way by saying turn it on its head, and I think you see the progression much easier there. The sort of desire for form births and non-form births and things like that, I think, is just either up in your head or in your body, or just being in the sensual world. That's really what it is. It's still a form of clinging to both of those. Yeah, I don't think we have to get too esoteric about these. I think the tradition gets very esoteric.
Well, I'm very esoteric, so I really go with those four. And I think of the immaterial as the deva realm, desiring to be born in a deva realm. And the Buddha said, not the best place to do that for. Devas don't have bodies, and so there's not enough dukkha to promote, wanting to be free from it. So, yeah.
I mean, that Deva realm, of course, is a realm that we can see around us.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
I
Yeah.
love it.
You've only got to look around, and people living in that Deva realm and thinking that they're in that Deva realm. Yeah, watch how they behave. Yeah, it's very manifest in this world. I mean, I try to bring things as much down to earth as possible, I think. Yeah. So actually, all of these things, look at them in the world. That business that you get in the Satipatthana Sutta, where the Buddha is saying, look internally, look externally, Ajita Bahidam in Pali. Look inside, look outside. That's what we've got to do, because actually what you're seeing on the outside actually is reflective of what's going on, obviously, in the inside of us most of the time. Yeah. So that's a quick response.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Before we get to the next virtual Zoomed raised hand, I'm going to pull us over into the chat because I can see we've gotten some questions in there. So this one is from Ray. He says, he or she says, I often hear experienced teachers speak abstractly about practice, and I wonder what their personal experience is like. Are you, John or Jake, in an Ebonic process right now?
Do you want to go first, Jake?
I can say something around that. I think I don't tend to think of this as a kind of all or nothing thing. If we're thinking of Nibbana as a cooling down, then for me it does bring in the notion of degrees. Things can be more or less cool. So there can be moments of, tastes of Nibbana, as we've been speaking about. And then moments where that coolness feels really profound. So, yeah, I don't really feel like I'm going to make any grand claims about my experience in particular at the moment or anything like that. But I think for all of us as practitioners, we can notice that there are these moments, different degrees of coolness and calm. In fact, actually, also the opposite. We can notice different degrees of agitation, can't we? I mean, sometimes things are very, very hot, the opposite. And then we can be aware of those moments when those times cease, and what's left is something more peaceful. Yeah,
Okay,
John.
I'll respond in a slightly different way. And actually, it's not that unrelated to the other question, which is about obviously about the fetters, which in the Pali, which is Sanyojana, which means to be bound by something. And the literal word, I presume we said this, but I can't remember exactly, but one of the literal meanings of the word nirvana, nibbana, in Pali and Sanskrit, is to be unbound. And it goes back to the metaphysics of fire in ancient Indian thought. And I'm not going to go into that, but it's the sense that when the fuel has burnt up, the flames are set free. They go out. of the fire. It was seen when you saw a log on fire, it was as if the flames clung to the fire. And when that had exhausted, then it was actually freed in sort of ancient Indian parlance. So just hold that in your mind for a second, because what is actually being said here in terms of nirvana is how functional are your fetters at this moment? How much bound by those fetters, those 10 fetters, are you? I mean, you could have a much bigger list. I mean, but these are the 10 big ones. How bound are you by them? So, as a question for myself is, as I'm speaking to the now, am I comparing myself with Jake or Brittany or anybody else who's saying anything here? Yeah. Am I speaking from some place of understanding, or am I speaking from a place of confusion? Am I feeling agitated because I don't like speaking on screens, et cetera, et cetera? And I could go through the whole list. Am I just trying to project my ego? We go right back to the early fetters. Have I got that sense of, projecting myself all the time and having a view on that self? Yeah. So that's what we're looking for. So the question is for me is, again, I'm not going to make any grandiose claims, as Jake said, is actually looking at what degree of unboundedness do I have at this moment in time, as I sit here in a very kind of strange situation, confronted by a screen with lots of people, probably most of you in the US, and here I am sitting in a darkened room in England. It's a very odd situation. And so, in what ways am I being bound by those things? And if I notice moments when I'm actually just focusing on your question and just hearing what's being said and really having to settle my mind to be able to focus on that question, I might get a glimpse of what it is to have a sort of free responsiveness to what is actually there in front of me, either you as, as you see, as I see you on the screen, or your question, or your speech, or whatever it is. How present am I for you? Because those fetters are obstructions to being present for something or somebody in this world. Yeah. So again, not making any grandiose claims, but it's like a checklist. It's a useful checklist to go through and say, I'm comparing myself here. Or I've got this view, I'm trying to project myself into this. Just go through that checklist, ask that question about yourself. And it's not a question of practice and not practice. You can do this in any part of your life. Just stop for a second and you can go through that list. And sometimes it'll become obvious what's there for you. That you are, getting a sense of inferiority or getting a sense of arrogance, or I'm focusing on mana because it's such an important one here, or that sense of, well, they're all the same, aren't they? Yeah. When we do that, you know that you're bound. When they're absent, you know that you're unbound. And that's the real sense of what we, I think, mean or meant, and particularly on that final module, is nirvana as a practice. Yeah. Practicing that unboundedness towards life. Okay. So I kind of dodged the question, but never mind.
Okay, well, we can go back to the chat in order, but Karsten, do you want to go ahead?
Sure. This is a marvelous course. It actually raises a huge number of questions for me. So I'll try to narrow down it down to two related ones. One is the whole idea of nirvana as a skill, which I really like. I think it makes a lot of sense. And one thought I have of that is if it's a skill, then it's not a noun, it's a verb. And that makes sense. It's part of the process. But on the other hand, there are these nirvanic moments. I've certainly had them. And that those moments are experiences. They're not just skills. So there's a skill, and then sometimes within that skill, there's the experience, a taste. And they're not exactly the same, even though they're related. So I'm just interested in your thoughts on the relation connected to that, I think,
Okay.
if I may. Connected to that is this great idea that we can think of nirvana as a anesthetized state. It's a state in which the emotions and the feelings and all kinds of things are there, including some level of suffering. And John, I think you gave that you referenced Rilke's reply to Lou Salome, psychoanalysis might sanitize the soul. And I've begun thinking about that. And what I was thinking is, knowing a lot of Rilke, that probably what he meant by that is he was afraid that his poetry would get less creative. And so, if I'd now put this in a Buddhist context, not a psychoanalytic context, do we need a certain level of suffering for certain kinds of creativity, especially artistic creativity?
No.
Okay. Jake, do you mind if I answer this one straight away?
Please do, John. Please do.
Okay, let me go back to the first opening comments about nirvana as a skill. The idea of it coming as a skill is that sense that I've just been speaking about, so I won't reiterate too much about that. It's that sense of being able to unbind. So if you see something arising, for example, you might be able to, through whatever strategies that might be able to you, be might being more present, being more mindful, all the strategies that we have in Buddhist practice to be able to do that, to unbind yourself from that, to create some distance between it and yourself. So it doesn't, in a sense, using a bit of Rilke again, become the habit that moves in and doesn't leave. Something he says in one of his Duino elegies. As a skill, and you were making the point that, of course, that it appears once you've achieved that to be a something, that isn't necessarily a verb. Well, I would actually put it back in the verb form because it's a way of being. And being is a verb, of course. So we're not escaping the idea of the sense of it still being a verbal construction. In there, because it's something that we're doing, something we're experiencing, something we are literally being at that moment. We're being unbound at that moment. We're not being afflicted by all the usual states that afflict us. To come to the second part of the question, suffering is inevitable. You're not going to escape it. Are we going to give ourselves analgesics against the suffering? I think that's what Rilke possibly was meaning by that phrase, sanitization of the soul. Because, yes, I think in his case, it's very much, obviously not wanting to turn this into a discourse on Rilke, but in his case, it certainly was about preserving that source of all his creativity, which was actually being enmeshed in the very stuff of life. And as we all know, no matter how much you try to avoid pain and distress and everything else, it comes looking for you in some way or another. But can we, and this is putting it back into the Buddhist context, can we unbind from the usual reactive patterns that arise in relationship to those pains of existence? That is different from the psychoanalytic, well, I think it's a slight misreading that he gives of it, of that idea of sanitizing the soul. We're not doing that. We're trying to be in the midst of life as life is occurring. It never ceases to amaze me that one of the other words that's often used, and particularly in the Bhujangas, the pillars of awakening, the factors that are required for sustaining awakening or generating awakening is virya. And one of the meanings of virya is not just energy, which is a standard translation, source of lots of English words, virile, vigor, all these sorts of words, but it also means courage in Pali and Sanskrit. It means a sense of courage, a sense of taking a warrior stance towards life, going into it heroically, because that there's going to be pain. It's how effectively we deal with it and not fall back into those repetitive patterns. So I think all of us actually, dare I say it, not perhaps to the standard, all of us can live an artistic life if we deal with our suffering creatively, if we deal with what we are confronted with in life creatively, then we don't have to, in a sense, create, I don't know, an artificial analgesic, which we might call meditation, to deal with suffering. Suffering is going to be there. It's really about how we add it on. And the bit that we're really dealing with, without straying too far from your question, is sankhara dukkha, the constructed dukkha that we place on experience. It would have been unrealistic, wouldn't it, of the Buddha to have claimed that we're going to get rid of all pain and distress and everything else. What he's saying is get rid of the constructions that you're placing on it. Deal with that. That's what's important.
Just a quick follow-up on that. Does
Sure.
that mean we need to construct more skillful sankharas? I
Yeah,
mean, the
that's exactly.
sankhara, we don't get rid of the sankhara. We
Yeah.
construct better ones.
We construct a bit, or you actually, I mean, if you take an Abhidharma approach, which I often do, it's not very popular in general. But if you take an Abhidharma approach, what you've got is a whole list of 52 mental factors. And I'm not going to go into them, but basically the main division is between kusala and akusala. Kusala, between that which is skillful and that which is unskillful. They're all of them sankharas. The ones we tend to focus on could just call sankharas are the unskillful ones. But actually, developing, if you like, the skillful habit of being compassionate and kind is a far better approach to being angry.
Okay. And to go to Rilke to turn the sankhara, to develop sankharas that are creatively poetic.
I mean,
A good way of dealing with stuff.
just one final Rilke quotation is, you say you're steeped in Rilke. Well, I mean, one of the sonnets to Orpheus, I think, is the last sonnet to Orpheus. Where he says, if what you drink is bitter, turn to wine. So thank you for your question, Jake. I don't know if you've got anything to add.
Thank you, John. Just briefly, I think in that exchange, you're both really bringing to my mind maybe a more naive and a more helpful way to think around nirvana and what this whole path is about. And if I'm being honest, I think when I first began the practice, I had what I would now consider to be a somewhat naive idea, but this is quite understandable. So I think I had the idea if I did enough meditation, then everything would be smooth forever. And I don't know about you, but that's quite an enticing idea. The Zen teacher, who's actually also a psychoanalyst, Barry Magid, in one of his books is called Ending the Pursuit of Happiness. And I love that title because there's something about the ending a particular way of approaching life. He also uses the phrase curative fantasy, some idea that there's going to be some experience or some possession that's going to make everything wonderful forever. And so, because our minds think like that, nirvana can be almost imagined to be this kind of object. But what you've both been saying is really turning that on its head and saying life is always going to have difficulties in it. It's always going to have loss, and we're confronting what it is to be mortal beings in an unpredictable world. There's something about that that is inevitably tough, to use a very everyday word. But somehow, really fully opening to that means another kind of suffering can cease. The suffering that's, continually in resistance of that. And the world shouldn't be like this. It should be exactly as I want it the whole time. Okay, well, let that go. And yeah, there's another way of being with things.
so we can pick up our suffering in another way.
We can.
Take up our suffering in another way.
Exactly. I think so. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Be lovely to hear another question, though. Brittany, have you been keeping an eye on the? Is it Linda who's next in order?
Yes, let's do Linda, and then I'll read another question from the chat.
Hi, Linda. Don't know if we can hear Linda.
Is a bit difficult to verbalize, but it has something to do with the idea of metaphysics and I mean, and altered states, and I think especially John was very adamant about being suspicious of any altered state. I'm it's I don't pretend to have any altered states, and not that's not the question. The question is whether having a more let's say maybe Mahayana view of the experience of nirvana, something ultimate, something is really counterproductive to a path. Because in for me, I don't find it so. I mean, I really think that there, I guess you could say, well, just to make it short, I recently found a teacher who is a teacher of Advaita Vedanta, and he's a very kind and loving teacher. But I've had many years of Buddhist practice, and I don't find that there's any real contradiction. It just opens up another sort of dimension. It's a way of thinking about reality that is helpful to me. But I just put it out there, and I would be appreciative to have your comments about it.
Shall I say something about this first, John? Is that okay? Yeah. Again, just from a personal angle, I really feel like I'm wanting to find a middle way when it comes to Nibbana between, on the one hand, something that I might sense as being unhelpfully romantic or idealistic, but on the other hand, something that's too reduced. And I really feel there's a skill in finding that, although I can name it like that, but to really find it is quite something. And what you're reminding me is that there can be also something that just really opens our hearts with a sense of wonder, a sense of possibility, maybe also a sense of what we don't know yet. I mean, I remember I said to someone, "Oh, I'm teaching a course on Nirvana," and they thought, "Well, you're a bit bold to be doing that," you know. So, but I'm certainly teaching that, but not from the sense that I know, certainly from where I'm coming from, I know the last word there is to say on Nirvana. And there may be that there's something about the idea that attracts our imagination that includes within it. Maybe there's more to this than I've quite known yet. And that can be very inspiring and bring up a lot of faith and energy. But it's interesting to do that then without falling into, as I said, that other extreme of what I see as unhelpful, excessively romantic ideals.
I
Again.
take, yes, absolutely. I understand what you're saying. I appreciate it very much. Leaving open the possibility. I mean, I think that the Buddhist practice is a very good corrective to any romantic ideas because it's so detailed and precise. So it kind of keeps one in a certain sense of what's real, But I thank you for saying that you also can that there could be more than you know. It's, I think that's what's important to me.
Thank you. And John, yeah.
I'll come in and say something. I think I perhaps I'd even go further. I think there's most certainly more than we know. And that any of these things, including where in the sense I'm really coming from, which is very early Buddhism, are maps. That's all they are. They're maps. They're maps to help us to see something. So they're devices to help us to be able to see more clearly. I personally go back to the sense of, well, this course was about demystifying nirvana, taking it from that very esoteric realm and bringing it into something people could actually aspire to, something really they could aspire to. And when I first encountered myself, when I first encountered early Buddhism, that was something, when I really delved into it, I felt, having come from actually a very esoteric tradition, which was actually a Tibetan tradition, which I was involved in for a long period of time, including being in India for long periods as well, was it like a breath of fresh air, coming back to something that you could do, something you could really integrate into your life and didn't have to use as a big system which you bought into. Now, having said that, that's a very personal view. I wouldn't want to place that on everybody else. So again, I take, Jake's position, or very similar position to Jake's, in the sense I think if it gladdens your heart, as they say, if it uplifts you, if it gives you a creative vision about how to live, then use it. I mean, my time spent in the Tibetan tradition was very much about, using the mind creatively, and all these tantric visualizations and that we had to do, and all the study I was involved in. It was that actually about using your mind in a very, very different way. And as much as I might critique it from a position that I, now teach from, I still think it's obviously a very, very useful path, but none of them, actually, if you like, are true. They're all ways of opening us to our experience and helping us to live in much more creative and skillful fashions. And I think that's the important thing. And it gets kind of lost. And sometimes I just have to admit, I even lose it myself. When I think, well, I'm teaching from the position of early Buddhism, and this is what early Buddhism says, and this is what the actual Sanskrit said, or what the Pali says, and lose sight of that fact, it is just a map. Yeah, it is the use of words that don't actually bind directly on to our experience almost directly. It's almost there is an unsayable, And that's what we're touching into, and that you can only experience. I think they're guides, and if the guide works for you, stick with it. That's what I would say. Thank you.
Thank you both. Thank you.
Okay, I will pull us over to the chat and read Miranda's question, which is, I am interested in the use of the word conceit. Sometimes it seems conceit as self-importance, and sometimes conceit as in the literary sense or a metaphorical construct.
Shall I respond to that? Okay. It's certainly not a literary conceit. I mean, there's all kinds of literary devices that we might consider a conceit. Samuel Johnson used to talk about a lot of conceits that authors had in their poetry and things like that. And it's certainly not that what's including here. It really is that sense of superiority, inferiority, or that sense of trying to level everything out to being exactly the same. It's a way of positioning ourselves, and that's what's important. So, more often than not, we would probably use in English, and this is part of the problem of mapping language, certainly Pali Sanskrit language, onto English. The nearest we have is the word conceit, but it's not ideal by any means. It really is more about comparison. It's about how we're comparing ourselves. In other words, how the self compares itself with you and you and you. Something that we do all the time. Often we do it in such subtle ways that we're not even conscious of it. Of the way suddenly I got that sort of brief flicker. We called it the odor of feeling slightly inferior. That my accent isn't quite right, or I'm not speaking and using quite as good an English as I could use. And it can go even subtler than that. Yet in English, it seems odd to place ourselves into that inferior position and call it a conceit. So it's not quite a literary conceit, but it's a sense of positioning ourselves. And the Pali word is much more about that positioning sense, the way that the self is positioning itself in very, very, very subtle ways. More often than not, though, we will use it in English as I'm conceited, or he or she is conceited, and they are positioning themselves in a point in that place of arrogance, overlooking people. Even harder to see, I think, from use of that English word is the sense of that, aren't we all the same? Now, this is not genuine equality. It's the reduction of everything, everybody being, if I see, I don't know, the teacher lining up in retreat with their tray and they drop it. Well, they're just like us. Exactly the same as us. Again, it's making yourself feel slightly bit better, by saying, well, we're all the same. So it's that constant sense of positioning, and that's what we really need to do. But it's happening, and it's very happening very quickly, and it's very difficult because it's so subtle often. Now, obviously, those feelings of inferiority or superiority, those big feelings of inferiority and superiority, we can catch. It's the more subtle ones that are much more difficult. And that's really what is meant by this word mana, which is the Pali term. Over to you, Jake.
Thank you, John. Thank you. I don't think I have more to add on that one. So maybe we'll go to Stephanie, if that's okay. Thank you, John.
Hi, I want to thank you for this course. I find it very grounding. And especially since what I wanted to ask about is that I have various kinds of energetic manifestations when I'm meditating. And, sometimes I have a big release and my whole body shakes. Sometimes I just get a concentration of energy behind my nose and my nose starts to twitch. And once I had a very weird experience where it was a sort of an internal vision of being in the center of a very large plane that stretched out completely flat to every horizon. And then after a while it went away and there was nothing, like nothing happened. And I couldn't help wondering how significant it might be, or these manifestations. And from what you have been saying in this course, it seemed to me that there was not a reason to dwell on them. So I wanted to ask about that.
Thank you. Can I ask you a question? Is that okay? So what does it feel like when these arise? Do they feel interesting, frightening, neutral, or
Not frightened by energy at all. When
no?
the thing happened with the vision, it was so peculiar that I didn't really have any reaction to it. It was at a retreat and the bell rang. And for some reason, I didn't think that I should just sit there while everybody else left the hall. So I got up and I went out, but instead of walking, I sat on a bench and I went back into it. But it was sort of raggedy around the edges and then it dissipated. But that was it. It was not like a revelation or an intuition of something. I've gotten more actual practical understanding of this process from the three of you in this course.
Thank you.
So it was just a thing that happened.
The thing that happened. Yeah, thank you. That's interesting. And that sounds a skillful, from my perspective, a skillful way to be with them. I think it's true that when we practice in meditation, perhaps particularly on retreat, people have a wider range of experience than is usual in our everyday lives. So there are all kinds of different things that arise for people that in a way are just other aspects of what human beings can experience, but they're just a bit wider than most people in the coffee shop would be talking about. So they can be kind of unusual, but not abnormal, if that makes sense. And
Well, I was thinking they might have some meaning, but I didn't know what.
yeah, well that's also an interesting question. I think, I mean, one perspective is to really look at the relationship to them, which is what I was kind of asking you about. So for some people, they might be very frightening, in which case, how can I be with the fear in that? For other people, at other times, there may be something around which a sense of self is born. I mean, John was just talking about the conceit there. So it's sometimes those experiences can feed a kind of conceit. Oh, I've had this kind of really different experience, and that means whatever. There's a whole story around that. So really looking at the relationship to them, any sense of self that could be constructed out of them, and then the very classic teaching to see that they're impermanent. They arise and pass, and we can notice them as they come and go. And in that way, we can be with these kind of experiences in a way, not in a completely dissimilar way we would be with others. Yeah, notice them as they come and go. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
And John, I don't know if you wanted to say more on these. Yeah.
Thanks, Jake. Yeah, there's a tiny bit, not much. Yes, these experiences come and go, don't they? They're very evanescent. They're very fleeting, a lot of them. Some are a bit more permanent than others. I have to give you an anecdote about years and years ago. I practiced for years and years feeling that I had my head sitting in my lap. When I was meditating, and it went on for Oscar. It was a really weird experience, head sitting down here in my lap. And I thought, I can either get freaked out by this, or I could just think, that's the way it is. So I just continued, and that was the way it was. And really, the only reason I'm relating that is because after, I think it was a couple of years, it was really quite a long time. It dissipated. It just disappeared. It went. And what it was really, and this is the more, if you like, the sort of more traditional way of looking at it, it was really a sign of your deepening sense of meditative stability. Technically, they tend to call this piti. Now, everybody tends to think piti is going to be nice. This is this state that you get, particularly associated with the jhanas. At a fairly early stage, not that deeply into it. And most people think piti, it's usually translated in ways which make it sound like it's something to have, is, piti.
Rapture.
Sorry?
Rapture. That's what I've
Rapture, yeah, absolutely. I mean, who doesn't want rapture? But unfortunately, the rapture that they speak about in these instances is not that pleasurable a lot of the time. It can be, for example, those involuntary movements of the body, the twitching of the nose, feelings of hot and cold running, strange sensations like having your head in your lap and things like that. It can be that, but it will pass. It's simply a sign. It's a nimitta. It's a sign of a certain degree of progression. Now, some people naturally fall into a degree of absorption, and so they get it quite quickly. Some never have it in their lives. And really, if you're having it, just experience it.
Because it's a very easy thing to build a sense of self around.
It is all for all the things that Jake's already said. I won't reiterate them, but it's so easy, isn't it, to build a sense of self and identity out of anything. I'm the kind of person that has this, and I do this, and that makes me, and then you start the comparison bit. So it's just good to watch them. It's just good to note them, and do whatever you're doing, whatever your particular practice is. Keep taking yourself back to the breath and body, breath and body. That's all you have to do. It's not something to get worried about, but for some people it can be quite scary. And I think that's why Jake was asking the question, if I'm not, sort of groping in the dark around it there. But for some people it can be scary. But it doesn't sound like it is for you. So just be with it, watch it, see it. Yeah, it will pass. Yeah.
Thank you. That was so helpful.
Thank you.
So we probably have time for maybe two more questions. I can see that Russell's was in the chat around 1:10, so I'm going to read that out. It says, I have a question about one of the reflection questions. I've been practicing in the Zen tradition for more than 20 years and was left blank with the question, what have you learned from meditation? What are you trying to get at with learned? And I'll just say before turning it over to you too, I know that those questions are developed by our team. So if you weren't trying to get at anything with it, then let us know.
Can I say something about that, John?
Yeah.
I guess what that brings up for me, the idea that we are learning something in meditation as opposed to trying to have a particular kind of experience. I think that's a really helpful shift. So the kind of things that we learn would be around the Four Ennobling Truths or the Four Noble Truths. So again, these aren't one-off learnings, but we really see again and again the arising of dukkha when there's tanha, when there's craving, there's suffering with it. I mean, these are things that we see again and again and again. Or when we see there's a sense of letting go, there's some peace there. I think really that's the thing to really see. Is that meditation is a practice in which very fundamental teachings aren't, doesn't, in my understanding, have to be millions of different teachings, but very fundamental teachings just seep more and more into our bones, you might say. We really see those Four Ennobling Truths, for instance, in our moment-to-moment experience.
Thanks, Jake. One of the things that the early tradition is very strong on, and I hear, I'm taking into account, obviously, you're coming from a Zen tradition, so I'm putting this from the perspective perhaps of why the question was asked originally. The early tradition is very strong on the sense that meditation isn't just about watching experience, it's also about learning. What do you learn from the patterns that you see arising in your mind? What do you find? And Jake sort of outlined some of them already. What do you find when you basically sit still, close your eyes, and see what's happening? You will find, after the mind stabilizes to a certain degree, that there are repetitive patterns, repetitive anxieties, repetitive fears, repetitive memories coming back. It could be just watch the show. The early tradition says it doesn't. When the mind doesn't wobble, and it uses a lovely Pali term. We haven't used it. I don't think we used it at all, but it's one of my favorite Pali terms. It's all sibilants, as you say. It's upalapana in Pali, which literally means the mind doesn't wobble, but it also is stable enough to start to learn and discern something that's going on. What it begins to discern, and this is very much related to what we've been doing in this course, it learns to distinguish, for example, the impermanence of phenomena. Almost replying to what we were doing with the previous question. You see that certain experiences are not stable, they're not permanent, they change. Even if it appears to be the same, with close enough attention, you see that it's different. Yeah, and that it arises and passes away. You see that, for example, that it is dukkha. Yeah. Because we try to stabilize it, and every attempt to stabilize something, if I have that nice experience, yeah, and I'd like it, then I try to stabilize it. Yeah. Often sometimes we try to stabilize not very nice experiences at all. We're just by clinging to them, holding on to them. And it's actually saying to us, well, do you discern actually that that's going on as well? Do you discern that that experience is itself painful? And of course, the third thing characteristic is none of them, none of that, if you like, the kaleidoscope of experience is ultimately reducible to a self or an essence within us. Yeah. That's what you're learning in every moment of experience. And I think that's possibly in a more slightly more technical way than Jake put it, is what is behind that question. Yeah. What do you learn? What do you learn about impermanence, dukkha, and anicca? And sorry, and anatta. Because if you don't, it's just, well, I get a better view of the mess. That's all. Yeah. Because the only way of unraveling, of course, is to learn something. Yeah. So much of what we consider often to be meditation is just simply, I think, watching the chaos. Yeah. When we start to really start to discern those patterns and start to see those patterns, perhaps as they start to settle in terms of the three characteristics, not that, we have to be so deeply attached to those, but they're very good ways of beginning to see those experiences. Then I think we start to really learn and then start to unbind from certain patterns of certain fetters and ways of looking at the world. So that would be my response to that question. Thank you.
I can confirm that we have gone through all of the questions in the chat. We have about 3 minutes left, perhaps time for one more quick question. Donna, I saw your hand up earlier. Just want to make sure we get, if there was anyone who had their hand up earlier, and Karsten, I see you, and
Thank you. Thank you. I'll just, and I do take my hand down because the discussion moved along. I was very interested. Thank you, Stephanie. Very interested in your comments because I've had those questions as well. And the teacher that I did seek out for this, because I actually have meditated alone for years, because I'm in rural British Columbia, Canada, and there's no teachers close by. But now, when I reached out to the teacher, she said to me, you're on a bus and you're heading somewhere, but don't be getting off every time you see something pretty. And I thought, oh, that really helps quite a bit. It's just enjoy the view. Anyhow, that was my comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Donna. Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it, to notice the different things on the path that may be, yeah, as you said, it's sights on the way. And I think kind of unusual experiences can definitely be those. Yeah, thank you for sharing.
Lucinda had a question that I can email you both about, John and Jake. It's about whether or not there's the ability to ask you more questions in email or in another means. So I can take that offline. And Lucinda, I'm taking note of your name so I can get back to you. But I would assume that would be shared with everyone either way. So yes, I'll
I still see
see what.
Carsten's one lonely hand up. Perhaps we have time to.
Well, I didn't want to ask all the questions at once, and there were too many anyway. But this is another one that was at one point in the course. There was a marvelous metaphor of comparing the patterns of sankharas to a knot, and that you have to untangle that knot, and you have to find the place in between. And it occurs to me that when you untangle the knot, you can't just see it. Sometimes, especially if it's really tight, you have to give it a little tug. And then I began to think, how do I do that in meditation? Because often I just see the patterns, I see the knots, and there they are. And now what do I do? Any thoughts?
Come on, Jake.
I was hoping to hear you say, John, but there we go. I shall. A couple of thoughts come to my mind, really. One is that, I mean, there can be these times in meditation. I think when there's a significant amount of gathering, collection of the mind, that it can almost feel like things are untangling themselves, you know, so that the unbinding and the untangling isn't a particularly sort of busy or interventionist thing. I mean, I know experiences where a thought arises and it's something like, I can't believe, and then it sort of the thought falls away. And I know when there isn't that level of collectedness in the mind, it's, I can't believe they said that, they shouldn't have done that. And there's a whole other story around it. And so you can have these experiences, just almost fragments of thought arising and just dissolving. So I think sometimes it's to do with the degree of samadhi in the mind. But then I guess to take that metaphor of how do we untangle the knot, the whole sense of investigation may also come in. You know, the second of factors of awakening, to kind of, really investigate experience, which may be again looking what's in the body, you know, a tightness or a tension in the body underneath particular thoughts, or sometimes dropping in a question about what we're believing. So a little bit more of that investigative element of meditation practice can also be cultivated and very helpful.
I would echo that. I would echo that. I think there's no one thing that we do. It's really asking yourself what is needed at this moment in relationship to what is arising, to the particular knot that you happen, or the particular part of the knot you happen to be dealing with. There are certain suttas in the Pali Canon, which where the Buddha gives whole sort of discourses on various stages. Primarily, the question, they're, sorry, primarily they are things that you do in response to what has arisen. Sometimes they can be, and this is not something, and not something he says, but sometimes they can be so knotty. He says the only thing you can do is push the tongue, push the tongue to the roof of your mouth and bite down hard. In other words, just swallow it at this moment, because there's absolutely nothing you can do. And he's gone through a whole series of things of saying, well, you do this and you do this and you do this and you try this and you try this, and if that doesn't work, then you do that. And really what it's saying is just look to see what you can do in each instance. But there's no one panacea in each of these things you can say. The analytic method, I think, is a very good one, of beginning to help to untie some of those knots. See, for example, in a way, I'm echoing again something I was saying earlier on. See, for example, where we're imputing permanence to something that's impermanent. Because we're often doing that. We are permanent-seeking creatures. We're often looking for certainties and permanences and everything else, just like we're meaning-generating and searching creatures as well, and trying to give meanings to everything. In these instances, though, we are trying to look for certainties and things which don't change. Look for that. Be aware of that happening. That's part of unraveling the knot. See if you're imputing I don't know, pleasurableness to something that's actually unpleasant. Yeah. I think some form of asceticism are like that. We sort of impute that this is doing me good, that kind of idea. And finally, where are we inserting a self when there doesn't need to be one in there, other than just what I call a working self? And where are we imputing that? So, in a way, if we're talking about the analytic method and the insights generated by the analytic method of untying the knot, and actually it's a particular, I can't remember again whether it was said in the course, but it's a particular thing that the Buddha says, who's going to untangle the tangle? Basically, the only person who's going to untangle the tangle is you. And the method really of beginning to untangle the tangle is seeing those three characteristics within. And the actual content of the nirvana we've been speaking about through the whole course, of course, is the insight into those three aspects.
Right. Could be a cone who is going to untangle the tangle.
It could be, yes, because there's no real permanent self untangling that tangle. Yeah, you'll find sort of paradoxes in this, you know, the self that desires to eliminate the self and all that kind of thing. Yeah. But on a serious note, just to finish, that's actually what we're using in the analytic method. You're applying that. Different traditions do it differently. So we can do it meditatively by just observing. So we're not doing it intellectually. Some traditions, like aspects of the Tibetan tradition, for example, which I was schooled in initially, do it in a very, very intellectual way through debate, of actually beginning to debate the same things again and again and again and again. So you begin to see that that's the case. Yeah. So again, a response. Thanks, Carsten.
Well, everyone, this was a beautiful way to share an hour together. And thank you for your wonderful questions. John and Jake, thank you for your wonderful responses. And this recording will be posted in Unit 1 if you want to rewatch it. I know I do. Yeah, wishing you all a really wonderful rest of your day or night, wherever you are. And thank you again for sharing the space.
And thank you, Brittany, for hosting it.
My pleasure.
Take care,
Thank you.
everybody. Good to
Thank
see
you.
you. Okay. Yes.
Bye.
Everybody. Thank
Thank
you,
you.
John. Thank
Bye.
you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everyone.